Hello, Lanthic Nation. This is Ray DeLucci with the Lanthic Thoughts Podcast. On this interview, I get to interview Chef Jenny Dorsey. Chef Jenny Dorsey is a professional chef and author, speaker, and she explores the intersection of food, identity, and vulnerability. And for those of you who have been following the podcast for a while, you know that Chef has been on the podcast before. I had her on quite a bit ago, maybe almost a year ago at this point. And when I had her on, I had intended to ask her all the questions that we talk about in this episode, but instead we got into the conversation of the sustainability of being a cook and what it's like to work in fine dining kitchens, as she has had a lot of experience in that, and I've had some experience, and we had a whole episode on that. And I really, you know, if you have not heard that, I would definitely suggest you go listen to that episode, because we got a lot of great feedback on it. I felt like a lot of people could relate to that episode. I was really proud of that episode and really excited over that conversation. So if you go find it, it's quite a ways back in the episode catalog, but definitely a good one to check out. But on this episode, we chat about the work she does. I really find her work interesting. She has a nonprofit called Studio Atao, and basically it is a nonprofit immersive events company that creates live experiences at the intersection of food, art, technology, and social impact. And, you know, I'm just like so interested in the work she does. You know, she tries to integrate, or she does integrate VR into her dining experiences. And there's always a positive message or a message for change that she believes needs to happen in the industry. And in this episode, you know, we dive deep into that idea of the changes that she believes, you know, need to change in the industry. And I was just super impressed and super interested in everything she had to say. And, you know, there are a lot of things in our industry, as we've seen over the last few years, that do need to change. And I think it's chefs like her who are super talented and are putting her work with food and her work with media out there and trying to create positive force of change in the industry. I think that's the chefs, you know, that are going to leave the largest impact in the years to come. So I definitely want to thank her for coming on. I also wanted to congratulate her. She just got done putting out a TED Talk, which I think is super interesting. It's TED, How Food Can Be a Source of Identity, Intimacy, and Vulnerability. And it was really great. You can go on her Instagram and check it out, or you can find it on YouTube. But really interesting TED Talk. Really great story she tells in there that, you know, I hadn't really thought of that viewpoint before, the way she told her story, and I was so impressed. So a ton of stuff to check out in terms of what she's working on and what she's doing for our industry. But I'm very excited for you all to hear this conversation, so I'll stop talking now. But I really hope you all are doing okay. Thank you so much for tuning into another episode, and here we go. Hey, Chef, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
If you just want to reintroduce yourself real quick, that'd be great.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Jenny Dorsey. I'm a professional chef, writer, and the founder of a nonprofit immersive events company called Studio Atao. We create culinary-based experiences that are rooted in some sort of bigger social impact topic. Best known for a museum exhibition and series we have called The Asian in America, which talks about the Asian American identity through six courses of food and drink, as well as virtual reality and poetry. We're currently in pre-production for another series, and another arm of the nonprofit that we launched this year does community initiatives, which I can talk about a little bit later, but those are industry-specific facilitated discussions where we have professionals from various industries come and discuss how they can better integrate social impact into their work. The most recent one, we gathered the food media industry, and we talked about how food media can better represent non-white cultures without tokenizing them, and had a lot of really great insights from that. And we compile educational resources out of all of those gatherings. So we just put together a toolkit about like tokenization in food media. So yeah, I'll talk more about that later on.
Awesome. Well, you know, like I said, very excited to have you back on the show. I'm really excited to kind of showcase what you've been working on. The last time, for everyone listening, that Chef came on, we had started to talk about it, but then we talked about another subject, which was more along the lines of fine dining and kind of the state of that part of the industry, which obviously I would suggest anyone go listen to. I thought it was a really good conversation. But first off, before we get going, I just was wondering how you've been doing during this, and, you know, just you know, making sure everything's been okay on your end.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. This has been a really hard time. The nonprofit is an events business, which requires people being together and eating things. So unfortunately, everything on our end has been canceled indefinitely because we just don't know when things are going to open back up, when venue partners and the such will even, you know, be open to hosting us. If not, if, like, our guests going to want to come and do anything like that. So that's been a little bit challenging. But we're hanging in there. We've kind of pivoted and obviously have been doing some virtual stuff just like everyone else and kind of figuring out what that space, because it hasn't really been something we like do. So we started this series called Community Skill Shares, where we have experts come and, you know, share their expertise with the community for free. And we use our research and synthesizing data muscles and put together all these like long resource documents that accompany said episodes. So, for example, we had two episodes about finance, one about personal finance and one about financial planning for small businesses that are CFO led. And we had tons of resources with that. And then we have another episode coming up this Friday with a woman who's a bakery manager, but also is a seamstress at night. Like, she just makes things with fabric, which I like can't even fathom because I don't do that. And so she's teaching a class on mask making this Friday, and then we're doing 4 weeks of mental health with two therapists, who, which I'm really excited about, like talking about navigating grief, talking about how to develop healthy coping mechanisms, how to, you know, process your different types of relationships right now, etc. And then we're going to do one on civic engagement and local politics. So like, that's been keeping me busy and just like giving me something to feel like I'm contributing, I'm doing something for my industry, and also hopefully like helping people.
All right. I mean, that's a lot to be doing during this time. And, you know, first off, thank you for spending the time to do that. I did see that you were putting out episodes kind of, like you said, helping with financial aspects for people in the industry right now. So definitely going to share that. But I did want to get into how you started out with Studio Atao and kind of what the story behind it was. You know, kind of how you thought of it or what the creation process was like.
Yeah, for sure. So I first started before Studio Atao was Studio Atao. It was something called Wednesdays. And before Wednesdays, it was something called I Forgot It's Wednesday, which is a supper club. I started in 2014. And the idea has always been and continues to be, how do we bring people together to talk about more intellectual, more deep, more thoughtful topics than what they're used to having in terms of small talk at the dinner table. And it became a mix of both friends and friends of friends, and then slowly like strangers. And a few months in, we decided to do a huge pop-up. We had only been doing dinners of like 8 people until then. And then all of a sudden we decided to do 100. So we learned a lot. And from that year on, my husband, who's our front of house person and our mixologist, him and I have been kind of hosting these dinners like ad hoc. And I never really knew what I wanted to do with it. I was consulting a lot on the side. I was doing the dinners. And then, you know, over time, I just realized if I wanted these dinners to be a lot more impactful, if I wanted people to not just come and kind of have a party, because we were getting enough press that people were just coming, not for the point of it, just to be there, then I had to really focus on what I wanted to actually talk about topic-wise at the dinners and have the entire experience be about that. And it needs to be kind of a bigger event planning sort of thing. On the same note, a lot of my consulting work, I realized like I wanted to do mission-driven consulting work after doing a couple nonprofit-based projects. So I think that everything kind of coalesced together where I was like, okay, I want this to have some sort of social impact. It doesn't make sense for this to be a for-profit ad hoc thing. So I turned it to a nonprofit, and the first concept that came out of that was Asian in America, which I mentioned. We debuted that in 2018. So that's the very personal thing for me as a first-generation Chinese American immigrant, and just using food as a platform to talk about different topics within the Asian American identity, from the model minority myth to the white male savior complex to the interchangeable Asian, and how that doesn't just impact me, but the rest of the industry and how Asian Americans are perceived. sorry, there was like a weird sad thing. I was like, wait, what's happening? Anyway, so realizing that like this made sense, I wanted to add different elements into it. And so kind of organically, like virtual reality kind of came about, poetry kind of came about. And that has been a museum experience that we've been touring since August 2018. So building off of that, I kind of realized this is like the niche that I want to play in, where there's food, there's art, there's a sort of immersive component, and there's also a deeper social meaning. So all of the experiences that we've built out of that so far has kind of been able to like tackle what the centerpieces are between each of them. We have one called Hidden, which talks about cognitive dissonance and self-acceptance. And that one has food and drink, immersive dance, as well as virtual reality and poetry. There's one that we're in pre-production for, which is called Glass Through Skin, which talks about the invisibility of female pain, the normalization of female pain. That one will probably be more like installation art plus food. But yeah, TBD. That's another something that's kind of been put on hold because of COVID.
Okay. So when you're at, like, I guess I would like to know more, like, when someone attends an event, I mean, you obviously gave the topics of what you've talked about in the past, but how are you able to integrate it through food, or like, your dishes, do they reflect what you're trying to convey in terms of like a personal message, or how are you able to kind of tie it all together at the event?
Yeah, for sure. So for example, in Asian and America, there's six courses of food, and each course has a specific topic. So for example, one course is about the model minority myth. And before the dinner, we'll prime all the guests by sending them a list of questions, about 2 to 3 additional follow-up questions for each topic for them to kind of discuss at their leisure. So for the model minority one, one of the questions is like, how has this impacted Asian Americans over generations? And how is it like, how is it still getting in our way today, sort of thing? Obviously, we send these in advance, and we're not like moderating the conversation at every table, but we have found it's hugely helpful in just guiding the conversation and also setting the tone that these are serious dinners. We hope that people have fun, but there's like important things to discuss, and the whole point is really growing with other people. We send things in advance. When people get there, they sit down. Every single course is either served with a poetry accompaniment or a virtual reality accompaniment. So for the poetry courses, there's a poem that talks about the issue of the course. And for the virtual reality component, when we use a 360 video. Once people go in, it's about 2.5 minutes, and they're watching a brushstroke by brushstroke recreation of the dish that they're about to eat. And there's explanation audio from me, like telling them why I chose these ingredients, what the symbolism is behind the ingredients and the plating style, as well as how it's, you know, kind of put together. So again, for that dish on model minority, it looks like a maze. There's certain ingredients that represent different things. One of them is like veal sweetbreads. And I draw this parallel between veal sweetbreads and Asian Americans, because veal sweetbreads, the main protein is veal sweetbreads. And I draw this parallel between veal sweetbreads and Asian Americans. Like, both are kind of somehow championed as like the good minority. Veal sweetbreads are an offal, and usually offals are kind of considered gross or distasteful. But specifically for sweetbreads, they're often, you know, used in gourmet dining. They're seen as very, you know, expensive and like gourmet versus, I don't know, like pig's feet is not seen that way. And then for Asian Americans, often Asian Americans are kind of put as like, we're the model citizens, the good minorities, and that's pitted against us, so that we can essentially continue to have like a wedge against us and other minorities. So just talking about using the food as a way to get people to talk about these things. There's a lot of anti-blackness in the Asian American community. There's like obviously a lot of tension in the Asian community and Latin community. So like, how do you use food as a source of that sort of difficult conversation?
Oh, that's interesting. And what is the reception at the events?
It's really interesting. People are like, everybody kind of responds their own way, but people get into really intense conversations. At our last dinner, we had this woman who, it was not a plant. She was a a very lovely new guest for us, and she was like literally modeling the table. Like she was like, wait, we haven't discussed like this question that was sent out in advance. Like she was in it. Like it was amazing. It was just really cool to see how people like just get fired up. They really get to know each other. It's usually groups of twos. And so like people, I mean, these are strangers and they are really like learning each other's life stories and like debating. It's, yeah, it's awesome.
That's really cool. I mean, I like the whole idea of the 360, like the 2 minutes where they get to see the plate come together, and obviously like a thoughtful dinner. I mean, when I first like heard of what you do and kind of what the dinners were like, I know we touched upon it before on the other podcast, but I think it's like really ingenious to kind of go into topics like this over food, because I think when you do dine with others, there's already a connection that you're able to establish. And I don't know, I think it's a smart platform. And I was listening to like your TED talk even this morning, and which I thought was really interesting. And like, I don't know, like things I never would have thought about, like how you were describing in your childhood, like the food that you loved, being, I guess, embarrassed to eat that at a certain point in your life. Like that's something I like, you know, wouldn't have thought of as someone who eats quote unquote normal food for the people around me, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know, it was really interesting.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
And like going off of that, like, so obviously with your TED talk, I thought it was like a really cool topic. I mean, when did you realize you wanted to start speaking out more about like how you kind of felt during that time and, you know, how we kind of don't realize these things in our cultures?
Yeah, I think it's definitely been a journey of like kind of understanding what I even wanted to say. I think for a long time I was very nervous about like speaking publicly, mostly because I just felt like I had a lot of feelings and I had a lot of thoughts, but I didn't know how to organize them. So I didn't have something like to present. And I think having like more years in the industry now and being able to interact with different types of people, I've like been able to kind of put my thoughts together more clearly too. Actually, one of the things that I think intrinsically understood that the reason I felt embarrassed about eating some of these foods or whatnot is because like I wasn't seen as the quote unquote normal, that I wasn't seen as the standard, but I didn't really understand what that meant. And spending more time with food writers who are really actively working on how to like decolonize our language and also work on like how we change the perspective of food media and how it portrays any cultures that are not white, it has been like really instrumental in helping me like understand kind of my own feelings, grapple with a lot of those memories, and I hope put it towards something like a TED talk that's more that is positive, gives people something that they can work like an aspirational thing that they can work towards for equity. I mentioned, or maybe I didn't mention this, but one of the things that we started doing at the studio this year is putting together community initiatives for industry professionals. And every single discussion is like a small group facilitated conversation about how they can integrate one social impact topic into their work. And the most recent one we did was for food media professionals. And the question was, how can we better represent non-white cultures without tokenizing them? So from that, we put together this huge resources thing on how, like a toolkit of like how to not tokenize people in food media. And so much of what we've heard and what we understood is we often center a very like Midwestern white upper middle class perspective when we talk about food. And I never even really understood what that meant until now, and how pervasive it is and how it influences how I see myself, how I see other people, how I think about price point, all of that stuff.
Okay. And so what is that perspective? I mean, like, how would you describe that perspective? Because it's definitely something I'm interested in kind of understanding right now.
Yeah, for sure. So for example, if you are reading, let's say, a thing about sushi, it'll probably spend some time explaining what toro is or what unagi is or all of those things. But imagine if you were in a place that it would, like in Japan, you read a pamphlet about sushi, there would be no explanation because the assumption is that you already know. So similarly, in the States, we don't say like, well, if you can like imagine, like when you're reading something, we don't stop and explain what toast is, because we just assume everybody knows what that is. So there's like these little assumptions that you think you see are baked into how food media assumes that if you're, you know, Japanese American, and what your knowledge is not the average American knowledge, but that what the average American, like, you know, nobody explains what Pop-Tarts to me. I didn't know what the fuck that was for like 13 years, right? Because I'm continually reminded through these little microaggressions that I'm not who they're catering towards. Or if you see how many times, you know, certain publications will declare, oh, like Filipino food is trendy now, even though this is a type of food that people are eating their whole lives, or they have always grown up eating. It's not like a trend. But first, nobody goes around saying like hamburgers are trendy now, you know, because the assumption is that people eat hamburgers like forever. They're not going to like stop eating hamburgers because it's not cool next year. So having this sense of, you know, what your background is or what your culture is has a temporary, very temporary component to it is something that you'll notice a lot. And then just on the back end, you'll see that for the most part, the mastheads of these media companies are primarily white, primarily male, primarily upper middle class, you know, with similar education backgrounds. So that way they also end up assigning articles to similar types of people who are in their social circles, right? So you will get kind of a narrow perspective on how one person sees the world. There was an example that was given at one of our discussions about how one publication, they sent a Latinx writer, but he happened to be Mexican-American, to cover this Salvadorian market, just because, you know, that's probably the one Latinx writer that they had on roster that they know in their own social circles. And there was a Salvadorian woman who she writes about Salvadorian food, and she was like, that like really hurt me, because there's so many of us who want to shine light on, you know, our culture, and yet it's like being told through the eyes of someone else, because that kind of like systems of power and access are just not there yet for many minorities. So anyway, there's a lot of ground to cover, but yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can definitely see how it would be a lot. And so when you're conveying messages through like your dining experiences and like what you're trying to achieve with Studio Atao, how descriptive do you go into things that some people might not know? Like, for example, like, would you just write your menu, or when you're talking about your food, you would just talk about all the ingredients as if everyone knows, and then that's it? I mean, that seems like it would be a good place to start from what you're telling me.
Yeah, I mean the approach that I take throughout the dinners is that the dinners are, we try to keep things through story, so it's not like, you know, you are bad or you did this, or like making these generalizations. I try to explain these topics for those who are not familiar with the mono minority myth by telling them an example of my own past. And then those who are familiar with it, because they inherently that resonates with them, they'll usually feel open enough to share. So I think the studio takes more of an educational like approach. We do explain things. We don't assume that everybody knows all the social justice topics that we want to talk about. For example, even using certain terminology, like how to uncenter yourself, and like that's something that people might understand but are not familiar with. Or whatever, what the difference between equity and equality, all those things, we like do take care to explain those when we're using them throughout our experiences, so that we don't, you know, alienate anyone or feel that people like they feel like outsiders, so they don't want to get involved and do more social good.
Okay, no, I mean it's definitely interesting. I'm sure it's I'm sure you have to put a lot of thought into how you engage with everyone. I think the story, I mean, going back to your TED talk, because I did think it was really good listening to it, is this thing that kind of grabbed my attention or really like made me like kind of shocked was you told the story of how when you were younger, you were at lunch at school and you had picked up a piece of meat with your fork, and you weren't like really sure of like the exact way to go about eating it at the time, and your teacher like called you out in front of everyone. I mean, that seems kind of crazy to me that someone would do that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so strange, right? When people, when the things that they're used to are challenged. And, you know, obviously that was like a terrible way for her to react. But I do think fundamentally it was like she didn't understand why I was acting in this, in her mind, brutish way by stabbing the whole ham and having it like, you know, in a whole piece, not like cutting it into little pieces. And I was like, I don't know how I'm supposed to eat this. This makes no, why would you serve something like this? And there's just so many of those like misunderstandings and also just like lack of understanding. I think because America has been so like America first for so long, I think sometimes we forget that there's just ways that other people live their lives that we're not familiar with because we're not the guiding light in their lives, and our culture isn't the only culture. So yeah, it's been weird kind of just like understanding that as someone who is obviously American, but also like identifies with many different other things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, it's interesting because, you know, I think that in like the food industry in itself, like for a long time, we've been focused on one or maybe like three different cultures, and those have been like the forefront of it. And as we start to get more and more into different cultures and what other foods represent their countries with, like, I don't know. Like I see your point of how, you know, you don't want to label it as a trend because this is something how, like, this is how someone's lived their entire life. And I'm sure if someone was to, you know, see that their entire livelihood of eating is now a trend somewhere, I mean, I don't know. I feel like that they would feel off about it, or they would be like confused as it's like the base of what they've been living their entire lives.
Yeah, exactly. I think that when we speak about foods, you know, it's never really just only about food and what they're eating. It's very much encapsulate how you feel about those kinds of people. I mean, there's interesting historical context that I mentioned in my TED talk about how Italian food used to be seen as really, really lowbrow. You know, James Beard himself was very like, I mean, he was French and he was a total asshole about Italian food and called it train food and nasty and all this stuff. And then as Italian Americans started ascending the social economic ladder in the U.S., Italian food has now reached this, this pinnacle, I suppose, where it's usually seen as very gourmet and luxe and expensive. And so like food is inherently tied to like how we see the people and how we see the food are connected. And so that's why if you tell someone their food is a trend, it's almost like telling them that at some span of time, they're not going to be important anymore.
Yeah. I mean, so like, as these different cultures and as these different cuisines get more interest, like, do you see a lot of cultures taking the same route as the Italian Americans did when their like cuisine and their culture started to rise and get, like you said, rise up the economic ladder? Or do you like, what do you see stopping that right now?
Yeah. So I mean, obviously there's kind of COVID's going on, so restaurants are on a bit of a pause. But before that, there was, I think it was in the Washington Post, or maybe it was in the Observer, I don't know. I think it was the Post, about how the next wave of restaurants is going to be fancy, expensive Chinese food. And because, like, as China's global dominance grows and grows, I mean, China has really kind of like overtaken us in many ways, which is, as a Chinese American, is like, it's like weirdly, like, I'm terrified because that's not great. And I don't agree with their government structure, but also is like kind of almost amusing. Like, oh man, all these things that I didn't used to think was cool, all these, you know, like jade rollers or whatever, and now like all these white girls like that. So it's like, it's a very strange time. But just being part of the Chinese American food community and watching like many, many, many of those sort of higher end restaurants open to great success in fanfare in New York and LA and SF, it's definitely true that there is a huge correlation between the two. And I think we'll continue to see that as China and America continue to like, hopefully continue to trade and work together. And it becomes overtly clear that like a lot more Chinese money and talent are coming here.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's interesting to see, and I'm interested to see how it grows, but what do you think the impact COVID will have on all of that?
I think for the most part, COVID has been like a very, clear message on like all the broken aspects of our industry. I think we're seeing the fact that many small independent restaurants are going to really struggle to survive this, while bigger restaurants and chains like are not, is because we have a pretty messed up way of like how we're actually able to make any money in the industry. Like the only thing you can do is volume sales basically, or have deep pockets and have an investor base, whatever. So I think we're going to see a lot of people in the kind of like independent small restaurants drop out or not be able to make it, which is really, really unsettling, because then I don't know what the food landscape is going to look like, especially in the major cities, because the, you know, the real charm or the importance of New York's food scene or LA's food scene or SF's food scene on the US is that it has a much higher ratio of these like niche independent restaurants and not chains. Like if they can't lead the way that way, and someone would argue that New York already has kind of fallen off that bandwagon. But anyway, for the restaurants that don't make it, it's like who is going to be leading the charge, you know, on what food, you know, the next generation of food in the U.S. looks like. I'm not sure. So anyway, I'm kind of nervous to see how all this shakes out, and then hopefully we'll also see some action around how we pay workers and like some sort of appreciation, I hope, for a lot of undocumented essential workers that we have, not just in restaurants, but also in agriculture. I mean, they really prop up both of those industries, and there's a reason those are such correlated industries. So hopefully we'll be able to understand how important they are to our economy, and that will have some sort of impact on our immigration system. But who knows under the current presidency if that will happen. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. I definitely share your concern over smaller independent restaurants, because like you said, those are going to be hit pretty hard. And also like the sustainability of being a chef. I mean, we talked about this in our last episode of how, you know, for a lot of people, it isn't financially stable to be a chef in a fine dining restaurant, in a Michelin restaurant. And so it's just like, you know, seeing friends lose jobs, seeing people that follow the page, you know, out of work. I mean, it's definitely been tough. And obviously a large part of that is due to the virus and everything shutting down. But there's also a part that, you know, it's just, like you said, the industry is, I don't know, I feel like we're not as stable as I think we thought we were. And I don't know, it is worrisome to see moving forward how we're going to figure it out, because there definitely does have to be some sort of improvement on how we take care of everyone, like how this industry is represented in the country. I mean, you know, why is there no more support, including not just, you know, the restaurant industry, but education of food in school systems more often? Or like, I had no education growing up on food besides a health class, and my, you know, like my health class just said a little bit about like the food pyramid, but that was really it for me. Like, I don't know, I just think there has to be more importance in general in food, but that's obviously another conversation to get into.
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing.
But I really wanted to stick with the work you've been doing, because obviously for some time I've wanted to have you on. I think it's really interesting. I think it's really, I don't know, I think what you're doing and how you're using your, for me, like, I guess what I really look up to you for is like, I know you're a very talented chef, and you're really using your talent to branch out and kind of deliver a message that's much needed. And while you could have, you know, just gone for fine dining and worked like really hard in Michelin kitchens, like I really thought it was a lot cooler to see you make this organization. And I know you're also an author, and you write cookbooks, and like, I don't know, I just think that path has been cool. What was it like for you to write your cookbook?
I mean, it's been, I've had a couple different experiences, and I think, yeah, they're maybe a little different from how other people find like cookbook deals. Both of them were essentially commissioned to me, or all four of them were commissioned to me in different ways. So I have one that's a client of mine. They make appliances, and they were publishing like a cookbook that would go alongside. It's not with the appliance, like you still have to buy the book, but it's like specifically for one of their appliances that can be used for air fryers in general, or little rice cookers in general. So that turned into two different books. One was about all these things you can make with air fryers, and one was about all these things you can make with rice cookers. And then from those, another publisher found my work and was like, oh, we're interested in doing a couple books on this topic. One was about Instant Pots, and then one was about healthy cocktails. So one I actually did with my husband, where I took all the photos, he did all the recipes, and then we both did a little bit of the writing. And then one was kind of more of like a science-y technique book about Instant Pots and like literally how they work. So very different types of books, but from the same publisher. And then that kind of spiraled into another publisher had reached out to me about a grilling book that they wanted to do. So all of the concepts of the books had all already been planned out. I've also gone through the process of pitching my concept, or not my concept, but a concept, like if, on behalf of someone else. And that's a very different path, very different like story. But yeah, at some point I want to do a cookbook that's specifically everything, like everything that I've made over the years and what I believe in, et cetera. But I just don't think that I don't have all of that yet.
Okay. Would you ever consider writing a book about kind of your experience? I mean, obviously that cookbook would share those experiences, but would you ever write, not a cookbook, but just like a book in general that you would kind of describe what you kind of, I guess, faced growing up or what you faced like going through the industry and kind of your ideas for change?
I mean, maybe. I don't know. I've never thought about writing memoir. I just like don't feel like my... I feel like people who write memoirs, their like lives are a little bit more interesting than mine, but
I don't know. I think it's an interesting story. I mean, I would totally read it, but I don't know. I think it's a good idea. I don't know. If you ever do, let me know though.
Yeah.
So I guess moving forward, I guess what I would like to know now, like after hearing everything you kind of shared and what you've been working on is, has the pandemic shaped how you're going to be kind of sharing a message moving forward in terms of trying to kind of get us off center with the views we have in terms of food media and how we kind of just view cooking as a whole in our country? Or do you think you're going to stay the same route of doing the dinners and, you know, talks and trying to just educate people as much as you can?
Definitely both. We've been working hard on, for sure, building out this like community arm, because as much as I love doing the dinners, I love building out these different series that we have. At the end of the day, like we can only reach a small demographic of people. It depends on every event, but like we want to be able to engage our community more than that. And also like many times people who come to the dinner, they'll come once or maybe they'll come twice, but it's also not necessarily people in food. These are people interested in food who like to go out and have an interesting dinner experience. They care about social justice and some capacity, but it's not like the industry, not the professionals that are like working in the industry day to day. So we definitely want to continue doing these community initiatives, whether they're the salons, we call them experimental salons, the small group discussions I mentioned earlier, that's a facilitated conversation, as well as these community skill shares as we like keep going to the future.
Okay. Can you explain what the community skill shares entail?
Yeah, so community skill shares, we have essentially a expert of some variety come in and do a virtual learning class with our community. So for example, who's our CFO, do two episodes about finance. One was financial planning for small business owners, and one was navigating your personal finances during COVID-19. These are obviously a complicated topic that people like either they kind of avoid. It can be kind of triggering for some people. It's not like it's just a very difficult field to learn. And so Matt explained all that in a video, and then we also accompany each of the videos with these big resources document, where we do a lot of research about the topics that we're covering. So for personal finance, like understanding how to use credit card debt, that's like a very weird and confusing topic, and breaking it down into like layman's terms so that people can actually, you know, get a better hold on how they want to use debt during this time. We have another on Friday that's coming up that's going to be about mask sewing. So how to make masks with or without a sewing machine, since we kind of need masks right now. And then we have four episodes about mental health, One is like processing grief during COVID-19. One is navigating personal relationships. One is about developing healthy coping mechanisms. And one is like therapy 101, like understanding, you know, what kind of therapy might benefit you during this time. And then we'll be doing a couple on civic engagement. So like, what is civics? Like literally, what is it? How does it work? How to get politically engaged? And then how does our government work? And then also understanding your local politics so that people can, you know, activate and make a difference, because usually local politics is, okay. Yeah, is the place that your voice is usually heard the most.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. You kind of cut out at the end for a second. Yeah. So just so everyone knows, like, I mean, obviously, if you just want to share your Instagram and like, where else can they find these resources at, anyone that's kind of looking or listening right now?
Yeah, for sure. So you can find the studio at studioatao, which is ATAO.org. And that stands for All Together at Once. So if you go into our website, you'll see a section that says resources blog, and all of the resources for all the community skill shares, as well as the experimental salons, are there. You can also find us on Instagram. It's at Studio Atao, ATAO. And my personal Instagram is at Chef Jenny Dorsey.
Right, awesome. Great. Well, you know, like I said, I'm very interested in this, in seeing this topic grow and kind of seeing you share this. I mean, you know, kind of just following along since we last talked. I mean, you've done a lot, and, you know, I just think it's like really amazing to see, like I said, you taking your skills and your role as a chef and kind of trying to change the society that we kind of live in right now in terms of the food industry and whatnot. Once this is all said and done, what are some dinner plans, or what are some plans for dinners that you would kind of go into, or what are some events that you might, that we might see from Studio Atao after this is over?
Yeah, the biggest thing that we've been working on is something called Glass Through Skin, which is about the invisibility of female pain and the normalization of female pain, and just talking about how historically the world has been built on women and women laborers and their work, but so often that is either seen as like non-essential, or it's seen as something that shouldn't be paid for. I mean, if you just look at kind of how healthcare works, there's so many caring professions that are notoriously underpaid, poorly staffed, et cetera, et cetera. Like if you look at how maternity leave works in this country and how we view you know, child rearing essentially, or how when women, like a woman with a child, are perceived in the workplace, all of those things, there's just a lot there to unpack. So yeah, that's our next experience. We're hoping to get that out. Timelines are really strange now, but hopefully before the end of the year, if not early next year.
All right, sounds good. The last kind of question I had, or last topic that I wanted to get into in terms of content you're putting out, which I thought was really cool, and I thought the photos looked really cool, like amazing, was the pantry engineering series that you've had on your Instagram, and also just the general knowledge post that you've been putting out about like how to stock your kitchen. Where did you get that idea from? And do you plan on doing more of that during the pandemic, or?
Yeah, I've been like receiving a lot of like, I don't know what to make, or like I've been seeing so many people start cooking online, and most of my chef friends are doing like cooking classes of some sort, which is great. So I kind of felt like I don't really need to be doing cooking classes because there's so many people already doing them. Is there something that I can do that would be useful? And one of the main things, like hopeful things that I've been hearing is like, oh, well, I want to spend this time to actually like learn how to cook and without recipes from people, because often you can't buy, you know, certain things that you would have access to, or, you know, maybe you don't find it's a great time to buy that one like obscure ingredient for this one recipe. So you're like learning kind of how to cook more freely. And so on that note, I think the most important way to learn how to cook is really understanding what you're using, because most people just like, oh, I'm going to put olive oil in here. But there's no like, there's no thought on like why I'm using olive oil or how much or what kind or whatever. Just like how we like put salt in and then we're like not thinking about the salt. So yeah, the whole pantry engineering series has just been about hopefully explaining to people how they can like build their cooking knowledge from the ground up and what they should be really thinking about flavor wise as they're creating a dish.
All right, awesome. Yeah, I mean, I saw those and I thought they were really cool. And yeah, I really like how well put together they are, and like the photos are really like pretty. So yeah, a good job on that. I just thought it was almost like a nerd moment because you see all these things that, you know, a lot of the stuff I do have in my pantry, and it was just like really cool to see it all put together in an Instagram post that was concise and was able to kind of share with people what they should have to cook at home.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad that you like that.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll be able to see some more. I mean, there's definitely some things that I thought were interesting, like the beef tallow, something I don't have in my
kitchen should.
That I definitely need to get.
It's really
what do you find yourself cooking right now during this?
I mean, I've been kind of using this as a way to also keep myself motivated. I try to do like one totally new recipe a week. So I'll just look online and like, what's something I haven't eaten before and try and make that. And obviously there's like little limitations on like if I can't buy certain things, but so within reason. And also like I don't really have the time, or it's more I have the time, but I don't have the energy to make something like super complicated. But for example, I did like this Polish like stew 2 weeks ago that was very different from what I usually cook at home. So it was really good. It was really interesting. Last week I did this like Croatian stew, like fish stew, that was also really interesting. And again, something I haven't had before. I want to try making that like Anera, like the Ethiopian sour bread. So like just giving myself like one experiment or one new thing to learn every week has been like how I've been coping.
All right. Awesome. Yeah. I think it's interesting to kind of ask what chefs are cooking right now. Cause I've heard a lot of people experimenting, and then I've heard a lot of people resorting to comfort food. So it's been interesting.
Yeah. I've definitely been eating plenty of comfort food, but I need to like make myself do something to like, brain active.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Is there anything else you'd want to share, I guess, on the topics we discussed, or anything else that you really wanted to get into on the podcast? Or
no, I don't think so. I think you covered most of it.
Awesome. Well, you know, I do want to thank you first and foremost for coming back on the show. I know we had trouble the last time, or my schedule had trouble kind of making the time to work back in September, but I'm glad you were able to come back on now, and hopefully you'll be back on in the future to, you know, help promote or support any other events or, you know, anything, other initiatives that you're kind of working towards. I mean, like I said, I really am interested and invested in the mission of Studio Atau and what you're working on, and whatever I can share and however I can help, just let me know.
Of course. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. You know, thanks for coming on, and, yeah, I mean, I know you kind of listed your Instagram and whatnot, but you also do run a podcast still?
No, I don't. I moved to Los Angeles, or at least somewhat temporarily, and the podcast is in New York. But it's a wonderful woman named Valerie took my place, and everybody should still listen to it. It's called Why Food Podcast.
Why Food. All right, awesome. Well, like I said, Chef, thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we'll chat soon.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
You too.